loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. Baltimore detective Sean Souter was killed with his own weapon the day before he was scheduled to testify against other police officers to a grand jury. The mysterious death is raising questions about systemic corruption and violence within the Baltimore Police Department. And then, will U.S. troops ever leave Syria? Now that ISIS is effectively defeated, the Pentagon is signaling that it will maintain its presence in the north part of that country, Syria, indefinitely.
But first, we look at Baltimore. Baltimore Detective Sean Souter was killed with his own weapon the day before he was scheduled to testify against other police officers before a grand jury. The mysterious death is raising questions about systemic corruption within the Baltimore Police Department. We're joined from Baltimore by Dominique Stevenson, Program Director for the American Friends Service Committee's Friend of a Friend program. And we're also joined from Chicago by Kofi Adamola, an organizer with the Black Lives Matter movement. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. So we have a very odd situation now in Baltimore where a police officer is shot in the head with his own weapon on the day before he is scheduled to testify against four other officers before a grand jury, all of whom have been indicted on racketeering charges. The police department in Baltimore issued a statement yesterday saying that they are convinced that this was a spontaneous event and that there was no conspiracy. But at the same time, this reminds me of the Frank Serpico case, where this officer's partner, for whatever reason, was across the street as his partner was being killed. Is this the state of affairs in Baltimore now, where the police department is just falling apart and it's not able to protect its officers who are trying to do the right thing and to clean up the department? Let's start with you, Kofi.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I always look at the fuller spectrum. I like to pull the lens back and look at it from a macro level and just look at across the board. When we look at departments and the violence that they're able to commit, whether it be on a civilian or their own, unfortunately, it's a long history of it. I mean, we can look at Philadelphia with the bombing of MOVE. You know, these were peaceful people just living their lives.
Right.
And the mayor sanctioned, you know, their execution, essentially, and the department, you know, colluded to pull it off.
Yeah, he actually ordered that a bomb be dropped on top of them.
Exactly. And as we know here in Chicago, Fred Hampton and Mark Clark were killed by the Chicago Police Department in cohesion with the FBI and state's attorney Edward Hanahan at the time, right? So, unfortunately, something like this isn't that far unimaginable. The likelihood that this, you know, is a conspiracy and that, you know, this is a cover-up by the department that goes high up is highly likely. I mean, all we can do is speculate at this time, but it's very hard to have trust that, you know, that the evidence will objectively be looked at. And then it's hard to even trust, you know, the FBI or the Department of Justice. I mean, they literally, you know, let the killers of Freddie Gray off, right? So how can we trust any investigation happening that justice will be, you know, served?
Dominique, I'm looking at I believe it's a Huffington Post article about the killing of this police officer the day before he was to testify against fellow officers. It says that a Souter, the now killed officer, a father of five, was shot in the head on November 15th after noticing a man acting suspiciously while he and his partner were investigating a 2016 triple homicide. In other words, something from the year earlier. He died a day later. During the day's investigation efforts, both Souter and his partner had noticed the suspicious man in a vacant lot and approached him. Davis said Wednesday, citing surveillance camera footage reviewed by investigators. Davis is the police chief. Quote, upon the sound of gunfire, Detective Souter's partner sought cover across the street, Davis explained. He immediately called 911. We know this because it is captured on private surveillance video that we have recovered. And then across the street, his partner was shot in the head and killed. And yet there's been no arrests. we can't prove anything. It's all speculation. But when you think about the fact that it was coming the day before he was set to testify at a grand jury against fellow officers, there is undoubtedly a lot of questions about whether this police officer was in fact executed. In other words, it's one possible scenario that's being discussed pretty widely within the Baltimore area. You're in Baltimore, Dominique. How is the community taking it?
Like, folks that I speak with don't necessarily believe in coincidences, and personally, I don't either. So, I mean, if the police department believes that this is not linked to that investigation, they likely believe in Santa Claus. They probably also believe in the Easter Bunny. I mean, come on, let's get real. You know, then they throw shade on the community by going in, conducting raids, locking down Harlem Park, you know, I guess to make it look like it's a legitimate investigation. You know, we know that they don't really apply the Constitution to Black folks in this country, but they boldly threw it out on that day when they went into that community, the way that they went into that community. And that part, to me, seems to be like left off of a lot of the discussions, how they treated the community after the situation occurred. But the truth of the matter is, I don't believe that there's at all any coincidence. I think that it's connected. That's my own personal belief. I don't have proof, but it seems like other people are speculating, other people, you know, outside of the police department that seems to accept that, okay, some lone suspect shot this guy down in this lot the day before he was to testify about corruption in the police department.
You know, Brian, I follow a lot of sites on Facebook that have to do with police brutality, and there's Cop Watch and Cop Block and all these different sites. I find the videos especially fascinating. And in fact, I consider them to be a public service. When this happened, what was it, a couple of days ago, my first thought was, hey, I've seen The Wire. I know what corruption is like in the Baltimore Police Department. But then I thought a little more about it, and I thought about some of the videos that I've seen over the last 6 months of Baltimore police planting drugs in people's cars and Baltimore police beating suspects who were then never charged with a crime. And I thought to myself, you know, that's what this guy was going to testify about. And it seems like a very simple 2 + 2 = 4 formula that, spontaneous or not, the fact that his partner sought cover, the fact that this was only one day before he was going to testify against colleagues who have been indicted on racketeering charges, we're talking about possible 20-year sentences here. There are just too many coincidences in this, coupled with a long history in this country and in the city of Baltimore of police corruption. There's too many coincidences,
you know,
this to have been a coincidence.
John, and for our guests, we even talk to people in Baltimore who routinely talk to us about police brutality issues, including the killing of Freddie Gray. They didn't want to talk about this. I want to get also to the, you know, the police have what they call the blue code of silence, meaning cops can't testify against other cops. And there's the impunity given to police when they carry out, as they do, an epidemic of police murder and violence, especially against Black and Latino communities. In other words, the cops are used to a situation where there is no accountability. And Kofi, I want to go back to the general atmosphere here. We have Jeff Sessions, who's now the Attorney General, sort of ripping up any of the consent decrees, that even the mild consent decrees that did ask for some degree of accountability for local police departments signed with the Justice Department during the Obama years. I mean, it seems to me that the current so-called Justice Department under Jeff Sessions is also giving a real green light to the police to roll back any reforms designed for accountability. So this shooting, this killing takes place also inside of a larger, as you said, roll it back to the macro sort of political situation. Talk about that if you would.
Yeah, last time I was on a show, you all mentioned it, right, when Trump was in front of the sheriffs or some version of the Fraternal Order of the Police, where he was basically encouraging police brutality, where he's saying that, you know, when you put a person in the car, just make sure you rock their head on the way in. So this is absolutely a department, you know, from the DOJ to Trump's regime, where they are pro-blue, they back the blue, but they're also for targeting and further marginalizing and disenfranchising people of color, especially black and brown people of color in poor communities like Chicago and like Baltimore. So, you know, it makes people on the ground very cautious, weary, suspect of how justice even gets carried out in something like this. Because we know on the other end, if evidence comes out that this was in fact a conspiracy and a cover-up, then, you know, people are going to demand accountability. And that means they have to give up some of that power and let the community sit at the table to decide what policing looks like. And we in Chicago have been getting resistance, you know, from that since Martin Luther King, you know, had that part of his points when he was fighting for housing justice and economic justice. One of the things he demanded was community control of the police. Same thing with the Black Panther Party here in Chicago. So there's a long history of folks struggling with departments and accountability. So now you have on a federal level where you're just going to see a situation where there's going to be light to little investigation unless we continue on the ground level to make noise and demand justice. I mean, people have to see the importance and the levity in this particular case. And you mentioned the blue code of silence. I mean, right now we have three officers that, you know, have been indicted for covering up the Laquan McDonald shooting. You know, right now in Chicago, there's the huge day of defiance. It's, you know, people are protesting downtown right now as we speak, trying to disrupt Black Friday, fighting for justice for Laquan. So that blue code of silence is serious. I mean, it's ingrained in every department where you absolutely don't say anything. You look the other way, and there's penalties if you do say anything. You know, we have too many examples of officers being ostracized, penalized, or in this particular case, potentially even killed because they pushed back against a system that has historically, systemically oppressed people of color.
We're talking about the killing, perhaps execution. We don't know yet. We don't know the facts of a police officer just days before or a day before he was scheduled to appear before a federal grand jury to talk about the role of other police officers in Baltimore, Maryland, who were accused of racketeering. Dominique Stevenson, the National Institute of Ethics, in a study commissioned by the International Association of Police Chiefs, surveyed hundreds of cops in 21 states. They found that nearly 80% of police said that a code of silence exists. More than half said it didn't bother them. Almost half admitted that the code was strongest when excessive force was used, and half also admitted that they witnessed misconduct by another officer but kept their mouths shut about it. Why? Because in many cases, they were told to keep quiet by other officers. Now, that's a survey conducted by the International Association of Police Chiefs, talking anonymously to rank-and-file police officers. They say, these police officers said across the board, the blue code of silence exists, and if you speak out, you should be afraid.
I mean, they see what they do to our communities every day. They have more than enough reason to be afraid of each other. You know what I'm saying? They see how they operate in our community. They see the things that they do to people in Black and brown communities all the time. And many times they're complicit in doing those things, so they know what they're capable of. Of course they would be afraid. To me, that makes absolute sense.
Yeah, and you know, they have, John, the police have guns and weapons, and they have a license to use them. And because of the lack of accountability, they use them routinely, and they know nothing will happen to them. So if there's a federal grand jury suddenly, and another cop is going to testify against them, they're like, no.
Not only that, it was very easy for them to carry that out in Harlem Park, a community that has a lot of vacant housing, a community that has a lot of poverty, a community that they could go in, like I said, and put on lockdown, and very few people would speak out about that situation in that community. So, it, you know, you had the perfect storm of circumstances there.
Harlem Park is where the killing of this officer took place.
Yes.
Yeah. And just describe what part of Baltimore that is and what it looks like.
It's in West Baltimore. It's not very far from Fantown Winchester, where Freddie Gray was beaten. It's also, you know, policed by the Western District Precinct. And you, like I said, you have a lot of vacant housing. You have poverty, but you mainly have a lot of isolation there.
You know, at a higher level, too, Brian, there is an utter lack of accountability, and we can't blame Jeff Sessions for everything. You know, the mayor of Baltimore is a Democrat. The city council is entirely Democratic. The mayor of Chicago is a Democrat. And yet they're doing nothing to police the police. And they act as though the African-American community is just going to have to accept this. This is a fact of life. This is how things are inside the inner city, and they're going to have to live with it. And that's not acceptable. And so what we need to do at the ground level is to demand justice from the local elected officials. As I said, we can't blame Jeff Sessions for everything. We have to start with the people who have direct oversight over the police, and they have to understand that this is unacceptable. If they don't make changes, then they should go.
Kofi Adamola, you're in Chicago. We're talking again, as John Kiriakou mentioned. I mean, you have a Democratic mayor, just as complicit, just as working things out, not only for Laquan McDonald, but for so many cases of police violence, police murder. We had in Chicago, and I think what Dominique was, the point that she was making, that when the police see what they do as a police force in Black and brown communities routinely, they of course know the nature and the danger and the possible violence that can be inflicted anywhere because they see it and practice it routinely. In the case of Chicago, you had a consent decree, I believe, based on a lawsuit where the police were actually routinely taking people somewhere other than jail to torture them, right?
Yeah. So again, we always have to go back to this historical piece. So John Burge, from I believe like 1972 all the way into the early 90s, tortured over 150 predominantly Black men and Latino men. That got exposed. He was never convicted till later on, and he still got his pension, right? Absolutely, with the three officers that had got indicted, in addition to Van Dyke for covering up the murder of Laquan McDonald, that's unsatisfactory to us because we know it went all the way up to McCarthy, who was the superintendent at the time, Anita Alvarez, who was the state's attorney at the time, and Mayor Rahm Emanuel basically suppressed the tape so he can get reelected. So they were all, you know, accountable, or should be held accountable in that cover up of the murder of Laquan. And with the consent decree, Rahm, you know, basically did everything under his power to make sure that there was no consent decree. As soon as Jeff Sessions hinted at not following through, Rahm said, oh, okay, great. Well, we're just going to go ahead and reform ourselves, which we all know is a lie and a farce. But fortunately, we got together with other plaintiffs and other community-based organizations that did the Campbell lahmsuit, which the city and Rahm Emanuel fought tooth and nail to throw our case out of court. But then when our attorney general filed a similar lawsuit, all of a sudden, Rahm says, oh, okay, we'll go ahead and go forward with the consent decree. But we still haven't made progress in that. It's still in limbo. That we still have to fight that out in court. But absolutely, we don't get caught up in the paradigm of Republican, Democrat. For us, it's about what's just, what's right, and getting power to the people. And right now, you know, we still look at the police as inherently violent, as a paramilitary force that has traditionally, historically, you know, played a role in securing status quo and dominating over poor working class folks. And until we flip that and police see themselves, you know, as a part of a community and protecting the community and not looking at all of us as criminals and being incentivized to play into mass incarceration by locking up brown and black people, you know, we're going to continue to struggle and always have to fight back against murder, terrorism, brutality, and incarceration, which decimates our community.
Kofi, you raised something that I think is so important, and it's kind of fallen out of the national conversation on these issues. And that is the transformation of many police departments across the country into what really amount to paramilitary forces. The George W. Bush administration and the Obama administration after it provided what they called surplus military equipment coming out of mostly the Iraq and Afghanistan wars to local police departments across the country. And we're not talking about bulletproof vests and things like that. We're talking about heavy weaponry, and we're talking about armored personnel carriers, and in several cases, tanks. I remember reading about a tank, an actual tank, like from battle, that was provided to the Ohio State University campus police. Now, what's the purpose of a university police department taking possession of a tank? Well, the purpose of a tank is to destroy things and to kill people. But what it does also is, in a very insidious way, it separates police departments from the communities that they police. It helps to cultivate an us versus them environment. And when the us is as heavily armed as American police departments are now, it's just human nature to be itching to use some of that equipment. And so we see violence getting even worse in the cities as the police use those weapons on citizens.
Dominique Stevenson, I want to go back to your point. We only have a few minutes left. And I because it really, I'm so glad you brought it up, because it kind of dropped out, is that what's actually happening to the community where the killing, perhaps execution, we don't know, of a police officer who was scheduled to testify against fellow police officers who were charged with racketeering before a federal grand jury in Baltimore. I'm looking at the Washington Post, and I want to read it. I think it's so important because, again, I wasn't not fully aware of what's going actually on there. Souter's partner, this is the police who was killed, who has not been named publicly by the department and is considered a police witness in the shooting, Davis has said that he's the police chief, took cover at the sound of gunfire and called in the shooting on his cell phone. The partner has been continually talking with detectives, Davis said, and provided the spare description police said they have of the suspect as a black male wearing a black coat with a white stripe. That's the description. A reward for information leading to Souter's killer has reached $215,000, and Souter urged people to come forward. Now, here's the next paragraph. In the days since the shooting, police have focused on Harlem Park, a small and violent patch of depressed real estate west of downtown in a city that ranks near the top, nation's top, in homicides per capita. Police kept the crime scene active for 5 days, restricting residents' movements as they searched for the killer. The neighborhood is marked by more vacant houses than occupied homes. So here we have, after this killing, the demonization of an entire neighborhood. And then the police shift their attention and all of the instruments of repression against that neighborhood, as opposed to possibly investigating the police themselves, who are, of course, certainly, seemingly, the most likely beneficiaries of the killing of a police officer who was about to testify against them. Dominique, again, let's go back into this for the broader part of the public that may not be in Baltimore, may not be in Harlem Park. I mean, it is, in fact, sort of taking advantage of this killing to implement what seems to be a reign of terror there.
Yeah, it's, you know, they have criminalized the whole community, including children, including elders, you know, and they've gotten away with it. And this is what they do. This is how they operate. You know, they turn this into a situation where these people who are actually being victimized by them, but there's no empathy because they have made them into criminals. They're responsible for the killing of this officer with no proof whatsoever. You know, but that's how they operate. That's what they do here in Baltimore. It doesn't make any difference that Catherine Pugh is a woman of African descent, it's never made any difference. This isn't anything new in Baltimore either. This is continually how the police have behaved here. You know, so it's not like, okay, wow, this is something sudden. This is their actual behavior. Nothing changed after Freddie Gray was killed. Nothing changed at all here. They continue to police our communities aggressively. They continue to treat our children as if they are criminals. Any one of us, you know, can be subjected to police brutality and murder.
I'd like to ask both of you the same question in the last 2 minutes that we have. Are there any bright spots here? Are there any police departments around the country that cities like Chicago and Baltimore can use as examples to try to clean these awful situations up? Kofi, can you start for us?
Yeah, I think you've probably asked the most pessimistic person on this particular topic. I sincerely believe, I'm a prison and police abolitionist. So until we rehaul the entire system and reframe it and restorative justice and get away from the carceral penal system of punishment and murder and having an armed paramilitary force, and until the community is centered and has control over these apparatuses, that to me there is no example of that outside of indigenous communities that have a little autonomy not to be, you know, interfered by local, state, and federal police. But outside of that, you know, people want to look to Cincinnati and, you know, New Orleans, but, you know, people, you talk to everyday people in the street and they're still being harassed. You know, they're still dealing with a ton of issues, and you can't separate poverty, policing, capitalism, and racism. They all are connected, and until we analyze it from those perspectives, we're going to continue to see this violence towards our communities.
Dominique Stevenson, we have 30 seconds left. We give you the final word. What do you want to tell the people here in Washington, D.C.?
That nothing's changed here in Baltimore. We're still struggling, and we need to keep on struggling, and there needs to be more pushback. Also, there needs to be more people outside of these communities standing with and for these communities, because these folks are the most vulnerable. I don't live that far from Harlem Park. We are all very vulnerable here in West Baltimore to police.
Yeah, I hear you on that. I think that's the most important thing, mobilizing,
right,
organizing, building solidarity, because as Kofi said, institutionally, nothing good is happening right now. We've been joined from Baltimore by Dominique Stevenson, Program Director for the American Friends Service Committee, Friend of a Friend Program, and from Chicago by Kofi Adamola. He is an organizer with the Black Lives Matter movement. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Will U.S. troops ever leave Syria now that ISIS is effectively defeated? The Pentagon is signaling that it will maintain its presence in the north of the country indefinitely. We are joined from the Bay Area in California by Rick Sterling. He is an investigative journalist and a member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. Rick Sterling, The Washington Post writes, the Trump administration is expanding its goals in Syria beyond routing the Islamic State to include a political settlement of the country's civil war, a daunting and potentially open-ended commitment that could draw the United States into conflict with both Syria and Iran. The one thing the opening paragraph doesn't mention, Rick, is that the United States has not been invited by the sovereign government of Syria to have any troops in Syria.
Yeah, that's correct, Brian. I think the article is interesting in a number of respects. For example, it's a continuation of the U.S. officials say line that we saw used so frequently in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq and just about every other major U.S. Intervention. You know, there's no attribution to who exactly they're talking with and what exactly is being said. So in one respect, this article is a pressure point from the neoconservative side trying to influence policy and what will be the outcome. There's they're stating this, but it's clear what their own, if you read it carefully, it's clear what they want to have happen. Another interesting element to this story in the Washington Post is it looking at the comments from readers, and it's on a very positive note, it's striking to look at how many readers are onto this now.
That's really the important thing. You know, I'm hard-pressed to think of an announcement like the announcement Rex Tillerson made yesterday that is more clearly against the law and a violation of international law in the last couple of decades. We've not been attacked by Syria. We've not been invited by the Syrian government to place troops in Syrian territory over the short term or the long term. So is it possible that this is just posturing, that this is just strategizing in order to try to pressure, let's say, the Russians or the Iranians, or maybe even to placate the Israelis?
Well, the question is whether the U.S. is going to basically return to international law and give up this intervention, the illegal actions, the financing of a proxy army in Syria or not. This is the big question. There were a lot of interesting parallels drawn to the U.S. support for the Contras in Nicaragua in the 1980s, right, which was taken to the International Court of Justice, which found that the U.S. was in violation of international law. But that was ignored by the U.S., and we've seen the continuation today. I think the big question now is, what is the U.S. going to do now that the conflict in Syria seems to be winding down with the government they wanted to overthrow still in charge, and with actually a strengthened Lebanese resistance and Iranian alliance?
You know, that's really an important point, Brian, because it's not 2011 anymore. There's not chaos reigning all over the country. We've got some form of stability now, to the point where the Russian government is talking about drawing down its troop strength in Syria. And I'll remind everybody, too, that it was the Russians that were invited into Syria by the internationally recognized government of that country. So the Russians at least believe that there's enough stability that they can start talking about withdrawing troops. And now the U.S., it seems, feeling like they've been late to the party, makes an announcement that that they think they'd like to stay.
There are many U.S. air bases, actually. I mean, these are primitive air bases, but they're air bases nonetheless in eastern Syria. You know, at one point when the antagonisms between Istanbul and Washington were going on, the Turks actually revealed the locations of the U.S. air bases, which of course upset the U.S. Defense Department a lot. But I think in one aspect, what we're seeing here is pretty remarkable. It's Russia and Putin that are the diplomats in this affair. They're bringing different sides of the party together, different sides of the conflict together. They're negotiating with both Iran, which has supported Damascus, and Turkey, which has been the base of operations for most of the insurgents. They're trying to resolve things. Of course, Assad went to Sochi, Russia, on Monday for an extensive talk. Obviously, Putin was talking with Assad about what is acceptable to Damascus and how to proceed with the negotiations. And then the next day, he had a lengthy conversation with Trump. So they're not trying to push aside the U.S. They're trying to get the U.S. to go along with a process which resolves the conflict. And this is upsetting to the forces in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, and Tel Aviv, Israel, which have actually supported the terrorists there. There was a story in J Post from March of 2015 I was just looking at earlier today. This is from a major Israeli supporting newspaper talking about Israel's support of al-Qaeda and how they're treating al-Qaeda fighters. So right now they're trying to, the neoconservatives who want to prolong the conflict and they want the U.S. to act as a spoiler, they're trying to turn the information, they're trying to misinform the public by implying that Iran is somehow allied with al-Qaeda, when the truth is the exact opposite.
It is indeed.
It's been the U.S., Israel, and Saudi Arabia that have have been playing footsie with both Al-Qaeda, Jabhat al-Nusra forces, and even ISIS.
Well, let's just try to understand what Russia's position actually is here, because here we have a situation that Russia, Iran, Turkey are the guarantors of the peace process in Astana, in Kazakhstan, the former Soviet Republic. That process does not include officially the United States, although I believe at the invitation of the Russians, the U.S. is there by invitation to observe. You have the Russians reaching back to the United States, though, even though it's not relevant to the Astana process and has not been part of the actual defeat on the battlefield of the main terrorist organizations, with the exception of the United States supporting the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces in the assault on Raqqa. But here we have Russia trying to bring America back in. I think perhaps because they're concerned that America will be a spoiler to the peace process if they don't have some role. The Russians also appear to be trying to bring in the Saudis. The Saudi, Moscow believes, here I'm looking at Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper, Moscow believes that the resignation of Syrian opposition figures such as Riyad Hijab will help unite Syria's internal and external opposition on a more constructive platform, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said on Tuesday. Hijab, the head of Syria's opposition High Negotiations Committee, resigned on Monday, nearly 2 years after he was picked to chair the Saudi-backed umbrella group that brings together the armed and political opposition to President Assad. Now, that would indicate that the Saudis realize that the writing, you know, is on the wall, that their side has been defeated. The Americans, too, recognizing that the mantra, Assad must go, as the dominant policy of the U.S., that's been defeated. Yet, I'm wondering, by the Russians reaching back to the Americans and now to the Saudis, whether some people in the American political or military establishment feel a little bit more confident that, as Mattis said, we're not about to leave anytime soon. In other words, is the Russian position towards America, trying to bring America in, might it just blow up and backfire because the Americans might take advantage of that?
Well, the American side may take advantage of that. They want to take advantage of that, but the different tactics, the support for the different opposition groups, the U.S. position all along has it's continued with the mantra of Assad must go. Periodically, they would say something different. They would say that's no longer our policy, but then weeks later, they would return to that. You have different kinds of statements coming from the State Department periodically, from Tillerson, from what's being said at the United Nations by U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley. So I think there's contention within the administration. And what we almost see is an example of, a problem where the U.S. is unprincipled, it's a dishonest, it's kind of a, it's being recognized or seen more increasingly as kind of a manipulator that will say one thing but do something else. Like, for example, how dedicated was the U.S. to fighting ISIS? When the secretly recorded meeting between John Kerry and Syrian opposition
at the United Nations. That's right.
Yeah. On the sideline of that, there was a leaked recording done by one of the Syrian opposition people where Kerry pointed out that they had been watching ISIS and hoping to use it to pressure Assad. Then you had the U.S. attack the Syrian military around Deir ez-Zor and allow ISIS to overtake a strategic position. And then just in the last couple of weeks, we had a big BBC story about how the U.S. allowed 4,000 ISIS fighters and their families to nicely depart Raqqa. The situation is that the U.S., unfortunately, it's not an honest broker. It says one thing, it does something else. And I think the Russians are getting more recognition internationally. You had, for the first time, you had the King of Saudi Arabia going to Moscow
right.
a few weeks ago. You've got them negotiating seriously with two major opponents, really, different sides of the conflict, with Erdogan from Turkey and Rouhani from Iran. And meanwhile, the U.S. Position is unclear, and it seems to be not to have a principled footing.
John Kiriakou, Rick Sterling said the United States is not perceived at this point as an honest broker. Fair enough. Again, so many contradictory elements within the U.S. administration or within the U.S. government having really different positions on Syria. That leaves one to not understand or not believe that the U.S. has, one, perhaps a consistent policy, or two, if it has a policy, it might not be reversed. Now I want to go back, and one of the reasons I think this discussion is so important for our audience is we're trying to help the American public, especially, that doesn't really know that much because they're getting most of their information from the corporate-owned media, try to make heads or tails out of why the U.S. has such a contradictory policy and what it might mean for Syria as the war appears to be coming to an end. To that end, let's go back and just think about this. In 2016, I think it was in September, there was an agreement by the U.S. government, by the Obama administration, at the urging of John Kerry, then Secretary of State, to have a ceasefire agreement with the with Russia's as guarantors, and there would be a ceasefire and then the de-escalation zones, the non-confrontation zones as the roadmap for peace. And then Ash Carter, who was then Secretary of Defense, said he wasn't for that policy,
right.
But he lost that debate in the cabinet. Obama sided with John Kerry. The uniform sector of the Pentagon also came out and was very publicly ambivalent about whether it was a good idea to go along with the President of the United States' decision for a ceasefire. And then 4 days later, after the ceasefire was to go into effect, the Pentagon bombed fixed Syrian Arab Army positions at Deir ez-Zor. And lots of Syrian soldiers were killed. And that ended the peace agreement that the U.S. and Russia had signed. So now here we are, it's a year and a half later, or a year, 13 months later, and there really appears to be peace about to break out in Syria. And Mattis telling the Washington Post and others, or perhaps these unnamed officials telling the Washington Post, hey, we're here to stay no matter what,
right,
in Syria. Is the Pentagon the force that's really sabotaging this agreement? And is the Russian diplomacy perhaps a play towards Trump to not listen to his own generals?
You know, that's a great thought and a very important thought. And it sounds entirely believable to me. You know, we were so hopeful at the beginning of this administration that James Mattis would be the adult in the room. He had seen war. He knew war was terrible. He would be the last one who would want to go into battle, right? I mean, you talk to most generals and that's what they'll tell you, that you have to let the diplomats do their jobs first and that war should only be a very last resort. We saw that during the Iraq War. It was the Joint Chiefs of Staff that fought tooth and nail to not attack Iraq. It was a political decision made by the George W. Bush White House. Now we're seeing what appears to be the opposite, where there is no diplomacy, in part because Rex Tillerson is a weak Secretary of State, in part because the senior levels of the State Department are so grossly understaffed that there is no one in any position of authority to make a recommendation, or once a recommendation is made, to make a decision. And so you end up with somebody like James Mattis, who earned his nickname Mad Dog, making the policy decisions here. Another thing, too, and this goes to the short-term thinking, not just in the Bush administration, but in the Obama and, I'm sorry, not just in the Trump administration, but in the Obama and Bush administrations before him. And that is, where's Turkey in all this? We just make these decisions as though the Turks are going to do exactly what we tell them to do. And in fact, the Turks almost never do what we want them to do. And so, you know, we've got a situation where we want to get into, you and I don't, but the administration wants to get into Syria and it wants to stay there in a permanent or semi-permanent way, but it has no real way to actually get in unless, as Rick points out, it uses these American bases, which are little more than strips in the desert in eastern Syria, coming in through Iraq. Well, you know the logistics that are involved in something like that. This is going to be expensive, it's going to be time consuming, and it's going to be very, very dangerous. So we don't even have our traditional NATO allies, Turkey, supporting this policy. Certainly the Russians don't, because diplomacy is working, and you know, God bless the Russians for actually initiating it and sticking with it. The Iranians are happy to sit at the table and negotiate a deal. So are the Turks. We're the odd man out on this.
Go ahead, Rick Sterling.
I think John's exactly right. We are the odd man out. We, being the Washington administration, along with the UK and France, which have been allied with the U.S. From the get-go. The Russians are, I think they're looking toward finding some path forward that will resolve the conflict, but which will allow the U.S. and the U.K. and France to basically let it go, to not be spoilers. And one of the discussion points on Monday between Assad and Putin was the proposal that there be elections, parliamentary and presidential elections in Syria. Of course, they have happened in the past. They've had that in June 2014. Assad was elected in a presidential election where there were two other competitors. But I think they're looking toward a solution which does include that. Also, upcoming, Russia has negotiated intra-Syria dialogue, a conference to be held in Sochi, I believe, where you're going to have this so-called High Negotiation Committee, the new one that's backed by Saudi Arabia, in discussion and with possible modifications to the Syrian constitution. So that's what they're looking at. And I think the big question is going to be whether the U.S. is going to be a spoiler in this process, whether the worst elements of warmongering and really the opposite of diplomacy are going to be allowed to prevail to prevent a reasonable solution from being held and being had and for Syria to do the opposite of what happened in Libya, where you saw the U.S. and NATO destroy a government, and where we've seen chaos and the expansion of terrorism. Will the U.S. allow the opposite of that to happen in Syria, where you can have the government, a secular, progressive government, retain power and negotiate with the opposition and make some modifications, but bring the conflict to an end?
We're talking with Rick Sterling. He's an investigative journalist. He's an analyst on Syria. You're listening to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker and John Kiriakou. You can hear us every day, 105.5 FM in the Washington, D.C. area, Monday through Friday between 4 and 6 p.m. We're talking about an amazing article in the Washington Post that indicates that the Trump administration, or at least the Pentagon, is announcing now that the war in Syria seems to be coming to an end with the defeat of ISIS and the soon-to-be defeat of al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups, that the U.S. may not be planning to leave. In other words, just even though they're not there at the invitation of the Syrian government, thus it's an illegal occupation, they're not there with the authorization of the U.N. Security Council, thus it's an illegal occupation. In spite of the illegality, there's just this plain talk, well, we've decided to stay. Ask last week, according to the Washington Post, how long U.S. troops would stay in Syria. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis said, quote, "We're not going to walk away right now. We're going to make sure we set the conditions for a diplomatic solution, not just, fight the military part of it and then say good luck on the rest of it." I mean, that's so duplicitous, because the American government, the U.S. government, the Pentagon, had nothing to do with setting the stage for a diplomatic solution. That was a consequence of the decisive intervention by the Russian military on the side of the Syrian government, and the Russians said plainly and straight out, look, the Syrian government's indispensable for the defeat of terrorism in Syria. It was because of the intervention of Iran. It was the intervention of Hezbollah. If anything, the United States and its allies, Turkey and Saudi Arabia and Qatar, have been supporting the other side, the losing side. So the diplomatic solution here is because of the defeat of the American side, not because of the American side. And yet Jim Mattis just says, well, we're not going to walk away because we've set the stage for the diplomatic solution. Complete double talk.
And he essentially lied about U.S. troop strength at the same time. The Pentagon only admits something like, I think it's 503 U.S. troops in Syria. And we know that that's not true because it doesn't count special forces. It doesn't count air traffic controllers. It doesn't count a whole host of logisticians. We clearly have well over 1,000 troops in Syria. And Congress hasn't weighed in on this in any way that would either slow or stop the sending of additional troops.
Another
to Syria.
Reason making the military occupation an illegal occupation.
Right, exactly. So I think the basic question is whether the U.S. is going to abide by international law or not. And Syria is making that point. They have not invited the U.S. Into Syria. And Russia is increasingly making that point as well. So it may, at some point, it may come to a head. It's clear that Syria and Russia don't want it to come to a head. They want the U.S. to kind of abandon its regime change project and recognize that we need to respect international law as well as other. It just doesn't apply to other people. But this article that, you know, we've been talking about from the Washington Post by Karen DeYoung, the national security editor there, and Liz Sly, based in Beirut, it's almost an example of the way the media can be used to influence policy and the way it can be used to really misinform the public. They bring in the neoconservative track now, of course, is to stop talking about Syria and make it all about Iran. And as I was saying earlier, the basic facts on the ground are that Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Israel have been supporting al-Qaeda and ISIS in Syria, and Iran has been fighting against them. So the notion that we're there somehow countering terrorism, the facts don't support that. Will the U.S. follow international law and recognize the territorial integrity of Syria? That's the basic issue. And that's kind of the bottom line. I think Russia's trying to find a way to maneuver through this thing, respecting Syrian independence and territorial integrity, but allowing the U.S. and its allies to kind of let it go without acting as spoilers, killing tens of thousands more people and risking an even greater conflict.
So the article, again, this amazing article in the Washington Post, which, by the way, the Russian government has now responded to. The Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman has said, if true, this would constitute, by the American government, a plans for the maintenance of an illegal occupation. So Russia is not going along with this concept. But here's what the article says, again, for our readers, in case they haven't read it. An abrupt U.S. withdrawal could complete Assad's sweep of Syrian territory. Sweep of Syrian territory.
It's his country.
It's his country. He's the government. It's sort of like he swept into Syria and helped guarantee his political survival. An outcome that would constitute a win for Iran, his close ally. Well, there was an election. You might not like the election. You might not like Assad. But nonetheless, it's the Syrian secular nationalist government that is the sovereign there. To avoid that outcome, the article goes on, U.S. outcome meaning that Assad's sweep of Syrian territory would mean that he could remain in power. To avoid that outcome, U.S. officials say they plan to maintain a U.S. troop presence in northern Syria, where the Americans have trained and assisted the SDF against the Islamic State. The SDF is the Syrian Democratic Forces, which are really led by the Kurds, and establish new local governance apart from the Assad government in those areas. This means, if true, that the Pentagon is planning to set up an American sphere of influence inside of Syria, working with others like the SDF to set up a local governance that would be loyal to Washington, because right. Washington would have set it up. I mean, it's imperialism 101, straight out. And the Washington Post, I just want to condemn once again, because they don't bring up this obvious fact about its illegality.
They never mentioned that this was a violation of international law. And I agree with everything you said, Brian. On top of that, it's also very sloppy. no thought went into this. This isn't some kind of, you know, well-planned out clandestine program that we're trying to implement. We're doing it in the press and we're doing it ad hoc, and it's very sloppy and ugly. And I'm just amazed that people haven't taken to the streets because of the illegality.
And the Post, owned by Jeff Bezos, of course, and Jeff, owner of Amazon.
That's right.
$600 million contract with CIA.
Mm-hmm.
Rick Sterling, we're living in the free world. How do you feel?
I wish that was true. And if the war continues, if the neocons have their way and they play the role of spoiler there, it's going to be with U.S. tax dollar money. It's going to cost thousands, tens of thousands of lives, and it's risking an even bigger conflagration. People need to speak out. People need to recognize what's going on here. And really, we need to bring the U.S. back into compliance with international law. That's the bottom line.
Okay, that's the voice of Rick Sterling. We've been talking to him from the Bay Area in California. He's an investigative journalist and a member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.